From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, health officials in Windsor warn essential workers who cross the border to Detroit daily limit your time in the city due to COVID.
Don't go shopping. Don't go, you know, don't even pick up gas, groceries, things like that. Just hop in your car and scoot on back.
Then we revisit a conversation about systemic racism in the healthcare system, even among Black families of means.
Wealth does afford a certain privilege, but it doesn't undo all of the harm associated with the system that, by its very design, has bias built into it.
And writer S. Kirk Walsh talks about her debut novel, The Elephant of Belfast, inspired by true events of World War II.
The animals, in a way, represent the suffering of the people.
Those stories and more coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, writer S. Kirk Walsh talks about drawing on history and her own experience to talk about a harrowing story from World War II.
Things kind of speed up and they slow down during crisis, and I think we've experienced that a little bit during the pandemic.
That's coming up later in the show today, but first, the province of Ontario in Canada is now under a four-week shutdown due to the rise of COVID-19 cases, and that includes the city of Windsor, just a mile from Detroit. Doug Schmidt, a reporter from the Windsor Star, recently wrote a piece titled "Bad News for Windsor as Neighbor Morphs into COVID-19 Hot Zone." Doug Schmidt, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by giving us some background about how Ontario's been doing during the arc of the pandemic?
We haven't been doing too well. Canada's had a hard time securing sufficient numbers and vaccines. So we're actually far, far behind what you guys are at. But we've been pretty good with, listening to the health authorities' advice and doing what they're sort of commanding us to do. As of midnight last night, we're in our third emergency lockdown, or it's now a stay-at-home order. So we kind of morphed from what was previously a lockdown. This is our third one. I mean, people are starting to get tired with all the lockdowns and shutdowns.
When we think about the last 3 months, what has been the approach in a place like Windsor? Can you tell us a little bit about what people have and have not been allowed to do?
Well, currently, as of, again, midnight last night, indoor dining is no longer permitted. Before, there was a limited indoor dining allowed, as long as you could safely distance. And there was outdoor patio dining. You know, any kind of organized sports, things like that are pretty much done.
When the provincial government uses words like lockdown versus stay-at-home order, could you explain the difference?
I wish I could. It's very confusing, and it's probably the main cause of frustration. For instance, if you're a non-essential business, you're to shut down. But say you're a Walmart or a Costco and you have an aisle dedicated to groceries, you can then open the entire shop, at least until now, in the previous two lockdowns. So that was causing a lot of consternation. I mean, the mom and pop, the small independent businesses were all having to shut down.
Yeah. You mentioned the fact that it's been so hard to get vaccine doses in Canada. It's just kind of crazy that there are Pfizer pharmaceutical plants right here in Michigan cranking out doses and they're not allowed to export to Canada. What's the scene like in Windsor for getting a vaccination dose? I mean, are you in a place right now where priority groups are able to schedule at all?
Well, as of yesterday or this morning, I think, there are no more openings until probably another week or so. Every time there's a shipment that comes in, they sort of open up another allotment of who gets what. But up until very recently, it's really our long-term care homes where we had the most deaths, the most infections. They've been largely covered now. But we're still only just targeting seniors. The broader population is still they're hoping that we can reach some of that somewhere down the line, but we still have a lot of essential workers who are not able to get the vaccine, including people working in grocery stores, teachers, students. They're still all ineligible. I mean, it was a decade or more ago that Canada got rid of its last pharmaceutical company that manufactured its own vaccine. So we're beholden to the world. There's a Pfizer manufacturing plant just next door in Michigan for us, but it's not allowed to export to Canada.
About all those essential workers, there are thousands of doctors and nurses and commercial truckers who, as you say, are still going back and forth from Windsor to Detroit and have been this whole time. Have you heard anything about how their experiences of making the crossing has changed?
Well, our local health unit, and we do, like you said, we have thousands of nurses and healthcare workers who live on the Canadian side of the border, but work largely in Detroit at the hospital networks there, the health networks. They're providing an essential service for Michiganders. Our health unit has advised those workers, though, that, you know, go to America, do your work, get back home. Don't go shopping. Don't go, you know, don't even pick up gas, groceries, things like that. Just head from your home and on the Canadian side, go to your workplace, get the work done with, hop in your car and scoot on back and, you know, do your shopping here and on the Canadian side, that kind of thing. That's like the main, I think, sort of message that's gone out. Initially, in one of our first lockdowns, we had a number of these cross-border healthcare workers who were bringing back the virus, certainly got infected. But I don't think it's a huge factor anymore, but maybe it's because they're listening to the urgings of our local health authorities.
So you think people are heeding that advice and not stopping to buy stuff? It seems like it would be awfully tempting to, you know, not grab some groceries or other things that might be cheaper on this side of the border.
Well, Canadians are an obedient bunch. When authorities say wear a face mask, they wear a face mask.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, it's pretty low level government intrusion in their lives. So they'll do it.
Yeah. You know, when you said that businesses are supposed to be shut down right now, except for the essentials, I thought of Canada's manufacturing sector. Obviously, manufacturing is really important in Southwest Ontario. Can you tell us what's going on with those businesses right now that typically need access across Michigan and Ohio?
Well, just in the Windsor area, we have about, I think it's close to or more than 2,000 companies and businesses that are linked to the automotive sector and to sort of tech industries. So they're essential here. They're essential in Michigan. You know, a lot of what they do is needed to keep the auto sector going. The problem they've had is that they're deemed essential workers, but there's sort of an odd definition on the border, whereas when you're an essential worker, you're considered a commuter. That's why the nurses and the health technicians and that, you know, the ones who go day to day to work, they're fine. Some of these manufacturing operations, though, you know, they have big contracts, but they only need to be over, like, cross the border periodically just to check on, you know, installation and operation and things like that. But it's essential that they do this. The problem is, because they can't prove that they're going back and forth constantly, they're being, you know, they're being pulled over and told, you know, you need to test, or worse, you need to quarantine. And we don't have a quarantine hotel here because, you know, non-essential travel is essentially banned for land crossings. So we have them at our airports. The closest airport that allows international flights is Toronto. So what happens is some of these folks who are returning to Canada are told, okay, you need to pack it. You need to drive up to Toronto, 3.5 hours drive away. You need to book yourself into one of these quarantine hotels for 3 days. You need to have negative tests. And when you get that negative test, you have to drive back home and quarantine for 14 days. It's onerous, it's expensive, it's not conducive to good business practices.
Yeah. Would you say that everything that's happened during this pandemic and the crimps on travel, and like you say, looking over the border and seeing what's happening here, what's all this doing to people's sense of relationship to the States?
I think it's different here in Windsor compared to elsewhere in Canada. We're the closest border city in Canada to the United States. We have so many relationships across the border here, family, work, cultural. Detroit literally is our backyard. And so we miss not being able to cross the border. There's a lot of things we're missing out on in our lives because the border's closed. Elsewhere, I don't know, people look at, you know, there was just a disastrous response in the United States to the pandemic when the pandemic first hit hard. That seems to have changed dramatically recently, but it's not quite on a Brazil level, but it was there for a while. It was, you know, why are you guys not doing enough or doing more? And I think Canadians, including locally, were quite content to see that border closed.
Have you been able to get a vaccination yourself yet?
I have. I'm an old person.
It has some benefits.
I was kind of fortunate. Our local area here is running a pilot program for the province of Ontario, which is the pharmacies, when they get supplies, are allowed to open up. And so it's just a matter of phoning. And if there's an opening, you go. And so I was encouraged to do so. And so I got mine at a local pharmacy.
Well, we're glad to hear it. And we'll be glad to keep following your reporting through this. Doug Schmidt is a reporter with the Windsor Star in Windsor. Doug, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on the show, and stay safe.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the past year, all sorts of industries, from policing to media to food, began reckoning with racism in their fields. One sector in which racism can have serious and sometimes deadly consequences is healthcare. We wanted to revisit a conversation from last summer about what systemic racism looks like in doctors' offices and hospitals. It was part of a series of interviews we did on systemic racism that recently won a Broadcast Excellence Award from the Michigan Association of Broadcasters. We talked to Deborah Furholden, professor of public health at Michigan State University. She's also associate dean for public health integration. And we invited Charlie Snow to join in. She's director of midwifery services at Henry Ford Health System and a founder of Metro Detroit Midwives of Color. Let's get into the conversation. I wanted to ask both of you a question to start off with about maybe an early moment when you were aware of how systemic racism plays out in healthcare, whether that's in a professional setting or a more personal story. It's up to you. Deborah, is there something that you could share with us about observations you've made of this?
Systemic racism and the issue of implicit bias is a tricky one, right? Because the whole thing about bias, implicit bias, is that it's hidden from the person, but the impact is very real on people. And one of the things that came to mind for me is the experience of being a 46-year-old Black woman who has a terminal degree. I'm 21 years post-op. And I was actually the opening plenary speaker at a very large Big Ten conference. I had on a black suit and a white shirt, and someone came up to me and asked me to get them a cup of coffee. I don't think there was any malice or bad intent, but that's the kind of things that we talk about. People see you, they interact with you, they make judgments based on these very superficial factors. Those incidents are all too common, and they're very common in healthcare. You'll have Black physicians and nurses who will come in, and a patient will look to a second or third year medical student and ask for support, not knowing that they're speaking right past the African-American well-trained attending physician in the room.
Charlie Snow, is there a story that you could share?
Absolutely. There are so many subtleties in patient care experiences that come to mind. Thinking of implicit bias as being the shortcuts that we take in stressful situations and the stereotypes that we find ourselves relying on that we may or may not be aware of. Just assumptions around marital status, African-American couples oftentimes not engaging a husband or significant other, just an assumption that they're simply there as the father of the baby, drug screening policies regarding African-American women, particularly overutilization of social work for resource visits for African-American women without any reported use or need for resources from a social worker. And so there's so many subtle interactions that I've been witness to on the day-to-day regarding the patient care experience with implicit bias.
Charlie, there's been a bit more media attention to the field that you work in and the especially heart-wrenching statistics. What do we know about the experiences of Black women in maternity wards and the maternal mortality rates when compared with white mothers?
So what we know is Black women are dying at a rate 3 times higher than their non-Black counterparts. We have had several discussions regarding the social determinants, but what we have failed to look at is the quality of care and what women experience when they are approaching care and interacting and engaging in care in health systems. And so what we do know is African-American women specifically report that they are not feeling heard, they are not feeling as if they are being counseled appropriately, and they are not being involved in decision-making regarding their families, their bodies, and their outcomes.
It might be easy to say that there is a huge gap in wages and wealth in the United States between Black Americans and white Americans. And so, you know, perhaps the root of all this is who has money. Deborah Verholden, does money buy our way out of bad health care as Black people experience it?
Wealth does afford a certain privilege as it relates to health and healthcare access, but it doesn't undo all of the harm associated with the system that by its very design has bias built into it. So even wealthier African Americans will typically have worse health outcomes, report poor patient provider communication, are less likely to get specialty services. African Americans are substantially less likely to get prescribed opioids for pain management, even when dealing with chronic health conditions. So income, to some extent, has leveled the playing field a bit, but it does not, by any stretch of the imagination, undo all of the harm associated with systemic racism.
You've both been involved in remedies for health disparities and implicit bias. And I wanted to move us into that. Deborah, I know you're part of the state task force, which predates COVID, aimed at enacting some solutions. What role do primary care doctors play in the care that Black Michiganders get?
They play a big role. These folks are at the front line. If we're going to actually dismantle a system that places a hierarchy on the value of people's lives and what services are offered to them and how they're treated, we've got to start by making sure that these very well-meaning and hardworking people have every tool, every resource, and every opportunity to provide the highest quality and the most equitable care.
What does it mean to give our primary care docs the tools for equity work?
You know, I always give the example of, imagine if you're driving, right? We all learned in driver's ed, you have a blind spot, right? It's that area just behind you, just on the side of your car. Well, how do you address a blind spot? Well, we all got trained, you look over your shoulder. And so I think of implicit bias as a blind spot. It's there, it's impactful based on people's actions, but people need the training to look over their shoulder and be vigilant and be on the hunt for it. Because literally you could have one person doing intake and triage in an emergency department, making major decisions about who gets what. And if that person has a blind spot that they don't see, we've got a gatekeeper now stopping people from getting into a system of care. So implicit bias testing, feedback, and training is, to me, one of the very critical tools that we need to provide people. Yeah. And then I also don't want to pretend that all of the problem is unconscious or hidden. Some of it is overt and right out there on the surface. So I also think that hospitals and healthcare systems and healthcare professionals need to be doing the work to look at their institution and just, what do the data tell us? Do you have differences in opioid prescribing practices based solely on the race or the insurance status of the patient? If you do, it's a call, it becomes a call to action.
Charlie, as I mentioned, you helped to found this network in Detroit of Black midwives. When you're out in the community, you know, talking to mothers and fathers, you know, maybe some of them first time mothers and fathers, talking to them about engaging with the healthcare system. And they may have had experiences where, you know, they've seen how family members have been treated in a disparate way, or they may have those experiences themselves. Is it difficult to ask them to engage with the healthcare system?
It is personally difficult to ask them to engage. It's personally difficult because there are challenges that I know they may experience once they enter care. It'd be great if I could say, hey, yeah, no, I'm going to catch your baby and I'll be there. But I know the reality is I'm not there and I'm not present all the time. And so what I think that highlights and what that calls is for systems to diversify. There has to be diversification of our clinical and our leadership teams so that we can more confidently encourage African-American families to approach care, because they can then have experiences from people that look like them, understand them, and they are less likely to have those experiences of implicit bias.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Charlie Snow, Director of Midwifery Services at Henry Ford Health System, and Deborah Furholden. She's Director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions and a Professor of Public Health at MSU. There are so many factors playing into the inequities that we see. Access to care, physician bias, affordability, physical proximity to healthy resources, food, and outdoor spaces where people can exercise and recreate. I wanted to ask both of you, which of these do you consider the easiest to tackle, and perhaps which ones are the most entrenched? Deborah, what are your thoughts on that?
I think one of the first things is that this notion that what is driving the disparities are these individual level determinants of health, it's really time for us to rethink that, because we've seen with COVID, and we've got good data that tell us that your zip code is a much stronger predictor of how long you can expect to live and the quality of life that you can expect to live than is your genetic code. So I think it's imperative that we start to deal with some of the systematic and structural impediments that prevent people from experiencing optimal opportunities for health. And one of the things that I think is imperative upon us to do is take on a real data-driven decision-making process. We need to have a fearless and unbiased self-inventory of variations in care based on race, gender identity, income, insurance status, because the problem is oftentimes the solutions that we identify for these problems don't match the level of the problem. The problems are often systematic and structural, but the solutions many times are individual level solutions.
Charlie, what comes to your mind when you think about the lower hanging fruit that can be tackled directly, and things that will need a more long-term approach?
I definitely agree with Deborah. Within our health system, the social determinants, health being where you live, where you grow, how you work, how you play, have up until this point been the low-hanging fruit, and they've been the focus of our discussion. And now, thankfully, we are moving to discussions regarding inequities, regarding the isms that have led us to these social determinants of health. So within our system, we have instituted programming that addresses the social determinants of health. We have group prenatal care, which is a proven evidence-based model that can help improve outcomes for African-American women specifically. But what takes a little more time and obviously more effort and awareness personally and institutionally is how to address the whys of how we got here. What we are now instituting and working to institute at Henry Ford is the unconscious bias training. We'll be starting out with women's health because of the inequities and the disparities. So we're working to develop a model that we can then carry across the entire system so that we can try to move that needle that hasn't moved yet.
Anyone who's been watching public health remembers that when Flint was going through the water crisis, there were some things that changed. And there were some things that did not. So many people in public health were sadly not surprised by the way that COVID has just ravaged Black families because of those disparities. Are there ways that you think of that COVID might be able to instruct us on solutions? Deborah, can you maybe have some final thoughts for us on this?
Yeah, so I think what COVID did, we've all been caught at our most vulnerable. It doesn't matter if you're wealthy, white, poor, ethnic background. You know, this is a tough time for our nation and our world. People have now gotten to see an inescapable truth that we live in a world where we place a hierarchy on the value of human life. And so I think this is a great opportunity that's upon us because the same types of solutions that we're mounting to both curtail the COVID-19 pandemic, but also to narrow the gap in disparities in COVID-19 will be very similar to the types of strategies that we'll have to employ over time if we really want to sustain and promote and develop, you know, the kind of sustainable healthcare solutions that deals with the systemic and structural factors that gave rise to these disparities in the first place.
Ladies, I feel like we've scratched the surface of some things. I want to thank you both for your work and for taking some time to get us move this conversation along a little bit further. I hope we can touch base again.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We're in this together. I'm super excited. Like, we are too strong of a nation to not emerge better and stronger. And the groundswell of opportunity now to make a more equitable society. I just appreciate you for having this conversation.
Deborah Furr Holden is professor of public health at MSU and director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions. We've also been speaking with Henry Ford Health System's Charlie Snow, director of midwifery services. She also co-founded Metro Detroit Midwives of Color. If you'd like to hear an extended version of our conversation with Deborah Furr Holden and Charlie Snow, just head over to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. The current spike in COVID-19 cases here in Michigan is a reminder, if you needed it, of just how exhausting this pandemic has been. With the Michigan Radio series Getting Through, we've been bringing you stories and sounds of how we're making it through this difficult year. Today, Elisa Gourlay. She's a mom, a wife, to an ER doctor, and a grad student. And one way she's been finding comfort right now is by cooking for family and friends.
I've been cooking a lot through the pandemic, like many people, but just lately I've been a little bit burned out on, everything. So I'm just trying to get back into the zen of preparing food like a normal person rather than just foraging like we've been doing. Ooh. So yeah, I've been cooking a lot. I started kind of a pop-up kitchen in my house making vegan tamales, and that went really well for a while, and then sort of tired of doing that for a bit, but I don't know, I feel like with the change of seasons, I'm trying to kind of get back into the things that brought me joy, like preparing my garden and cooking big complicated things. And a year into this pandemic, it feels like everything that ever brought us joy is sort of worn out, like we've used it all up. So I'm trying to figure out how to approach old things in a new way or find new things. So yeah, we're just trying to hang on till some more people are vaccinated, till the weather turns, till, I don't know, till something happens. I don't know what. Hopefully it'll be soon though. Air fried chicken. Smells amazing.
Share your stories of getting through. Just head over to michiganradio.org. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Detroit-born writer S. Kirk Walsh just published a highly anticipated historical novel that's set in Northern Ireland during World War II. The Elephant of Belfast is based on a true story about a young woman who cared for her zoo's star attraction, a young Indian elephant, amid a spate of German bombings that leveled the city. The zookeeper in the novel, Hetty, ends up bonding with the elephant and taking her home to protect her. Kirk Walsh, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me, April.
This is such a remarkable story. How did you first hear about it?
I actually heard about it on the radio. I believe it was NPR, but it was in 2009. I was driving on Interstate 35 here in Texas, and the Belfast Zoo, the elephant angel was a mysterious woman who had taken care of an elephant in 1941, and they didn't know her identity. And they did a campaign to find out who she was, and her last living relative, David Ramsey, heard that call and called up the zoo and told them it was Denise Austin. And so I borrowed a lot of the scaffolding of the true story for my novel and, you know, did make a trip to Belfast in 2013 and interviewed Blitz survivors and did a lot of research along the way. So, but I, yeah, first heard it on the radio.
Of course.
Yes.
You have a really amazing way of rendering 1940 Belfast in a way that made me see it. For those who've never been there, what is Belfast like? Are you able to, is it one of those places where you're able to see its history and the structures that exist today?
Yes, definitely. I would say the highlight of writing this book was going to Belfast. My husband and I experienced so much generosity and kindness when we were there, and we were shown around the city, and there are many layers of history to the city. And I also, up at the zoo, there's the new zoo, and below the new zoo is where the old zoo exists, and it's all overgrown with weeds and grasses, but one of the zookeepers took us down there and showed us, like, I got to see the actual elephant house, which was amazing just to be able to walk inside it. That really gave me a sense of how I was going to write those scenes.
Right. So the protagonist of your novel is not Denise. It's a young woman named Hattie. Mm-hmm. And she's someone who knows exactly what she wants to do with her life. She wants to take care of animals as a zookeeper. But at the same time, she's at a bit of a loss about how to proceed, and that intersects with her own feelings of emotional instability. Her family has just been through two very tough things. Her father has run off, and her much-loved older sister has just died in childbirth. Could you talk about spending some time with Hetty, so to speak, and what you liked about her and how she challenged you?
Yeah, she was a challenging character to write because a young woman in 1940 had very limited choices. And so to kind of animate her agency, it took time to figure out just how to make her a dynamic character. I did initially, when I started the book, I was writing for an audience of one, my grandmother, who's my namesake, Helen Kirk Wright. Her brother was named Bernard Kirk, and he was an All-American football player for the University of Michigan. And he was at the height of his career, and he died in a tragic car accident in 1922 when my grandmother was 19 years old. And I think I wanted to try to understand what it might have been like for her to lose a beloved sibling who was beloved by so many other people. And that was kind of my starting point for her. And I do have a sister in real life who is also a writer and talented athlete. And I think some part of me was imagining a worst case scenario if I ever lost her, what it would be like for me.
Right. There's plenty in this book about how we are processing trauma both in the moment and after it happens. Would you read for us from the book? There's a passage where Hetty is with Violet during one of the bombings.
Yes. This is from the night of Easter Tuesday, which the anniversary, it's the 80th anniversary this week, which is...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This is, Hetty has gone to the zoo to see if Violet's okay during the bombings, and she had just arrived. "I'm here, Vi," Hetty said softly. "I'm here." Light gathered and scattered in the sky. Hetty heard the continuing drone of aircraft. Dozens of bombers were up there now, and they all seemed to be approaching from the northeast along the shores of the Belfast Lock and flying directly over the Whitewell Road. Hetty rubbed Violet absently behind one of her ears. The elephant's skin felt cold and clammy. She rested her cheek against Violet's heaving side and rubbed the elephant behind her ear again, speaking softly to her, the way that Thomas used to whisper to Hetty when she couldn't fall asleep when a thunderstorm rolled over their neighborhood. Only then did she notice the wall of animal cries and howls that surrounded the elephant house. It was different than the other night, louder, fiercer. And it came from all sides. Like everything was escalating to another level, another volume, another rung of fear, another circle of violence. As Hetty listened, the fine hairs on the nape of her neck stood on end. The animals' calls gained more definition. The growls of lions and leopards, the roars of the black bears, the cackles of the hyenas, the shrieks of the monkeys and the baboons, the brays of the sea lions, the squawks of the toucans and the macaws. It was as if a call and response were taking place between the animals, and the shadows and darkness transformed into its own sort of mythic cathedral, with all of its devout congregants praying in their own distinctive tongues at the sacred altar of their greater animal god, with hopes of reaching a higher state, a higher consciousness, so they could endure this suffering of higher proportions. They were singing to something.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer S. Kirk Walsh. Her new historical novel is The Elephant of Belfast. This isn't the first historical novel I've read from that era, World War II in Europe, and it's not even the first historical novel I've read of World War II in Europe that chronicles what zookeepers were going through. But you brought so much to this book in terms of Hetty and her relationship with Violet, this elephant that she's caring for, and also in terms of Hetty's ambitions and gifts while also acknowledging the parameters of women's lives at that time. You mentioned that it was challenging, but I was curious about how you thought through those parts of the story.
I think It was a lot of revision. So I did work on this book for a long time, and it took about 16 drafts to get it to where people will be reading it. Yeah. And as I mentioned earlier, I was drawing from my own experiences of living in New York City during the attacks of September 11th. And one thing that me, among many New Yorkers, heard time and time again was individuals who decided not to go to work that day because they didn't feel well, or someone who was walking into the World Trade Center and turned around to go get a cup of coffee. And just those kind of split-second decisions that changes the trajectory of a person's life. And I think I was interested in sort of how velocity, things kind of speed up and they slow down during crisis. And I think we've experienced that a little bit during the pandemic. I did do a lot of elephant research, and I think that helped. I did meet the elephant at the Belfast Zoo, but my firsthand elephant research was back here in the States. I went to the Houston Zoo, and I spent 2 days with the elephants there, and I was really fortunate that I got to bathe one of the elephants and really kind of see what the size was like and what its skin felt like. And also I got to witness the zookeepers doing all the feedings and treatments, and it really gave me a sense of what it would be like to be a zookeeper, but also with a young elephant, because these elephants were the age of the elephant in the story. And that, I think, helped a lot.
Kirk, you include some things in the story, really terrible things that Hetty has to witness as the bombings drive the local government to think about safety, public safety, in ways that previously would have been unimaginable. And there are the horrors of the bombings themselves. Why did you think it was important to confront some of the realities of wartime zookeeping?
Well, because it's a part of the true story, and I felt like the animals, in a way, represent the suffering of the people. And to be able to show just how devastating and horrific it is.
Yeah. At the same time, the animals not only give us a little more access to, you know, to the trauma that happened, but also to, I feel like through the animals' reactions, there are certain animal reactions that humans have when they're in really terrible situations. And it seems like the bombings are one of the few places Hetty has where she can release her own grief as she's releasing this physical sense of terror.
I do think it is in the scenes, as I mentioned earlier, where she develops her agency and can follow her intuitions without worrying about the authorities around her, and she does come into her own. And the book begins on the Antrim Road, and it ends on the Antrim Road, which is one of the main arteries in Belfast. And Hetty is a very different young woman in that opening scene, and how she is around Violet as they process her up to the zoo. And in the closing scene where she's leading the elephant rather than being led by the elephant.
The book includes some context and some nods to sectarian violence. And I know that you're aware that Belfast has been the site of unrest over the past couple of days. And I just wondered, as somebody who's been to Belfast and spent time with its people, what's on your mind as you see what's happening there right now?
I feel it makes me sad and feel a lot of compassion for the city and the people of Belfast. When we were there, it was in July, which is when there's can be some unrest around the Orange Order and marches through Catholic neighborhoods. So we experienced it in a very minor way. There wasn't much, did not happen. I never felt scared there. You know, when I asked people about the sectarian conflict around World War II, no one really wanted to talk about it. They mostly said that wasn't going on during that time. And it took help from Brian Barton, the historian, and a lot more digging to kind of see how that was playing out. And it certainly was, as you know, from reading the book. And I think that's also kind of a lesser known fact that people don't know much about. I mean, they don't know much about the Belfast Blitz, but they also just assume that Ireland was neutral and forget that Belfast is a huge ship-making port and was producing arsenal for the British, and that's why the Germans came up. But I think today's violence, for me, is a reminder of, you know, during the past year here in the States, we've had violence and unrest, and it's been very unsettling. And in Belfast, they've been going through this for years. And the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, you know, did create some peace. And, you know, my hope is that they'll be able to come to some agreement so that that peace can return. And it's a little unknown right now, but I feel a lot of compassion. And like I said, I feel like because of the past year, you know, particularly in early January, what happened at the Capitol, we have a little bit more, not that it's the exact same at all, but just what it's like to have counter forces creating violence where you live.
Kirk, your website says that you've been working on something related to Detroit recently. Is there anything you can tell us?
Yes. It's also set in World War II, and I'm excited to write about Detroit, you know, being my hometown. There are similarities to the Elephant of Belfast in terms of, as many people know, Ford became a producer of arsenal during the war as well. And there were a lot of tensions that played out in Detroit during that time because of the Great Migration. And a lot of people are aware of the riots in the city in the late 60s, but there was another riot that happened in 1943, and it was related to the tensions in the city around Black people coming up to work in the factories and other groups not being so happy about that. So I'm still in the early stages. So we'll see what it's about exactly when I get through a couple more drafts.
S. Kirk Walsh is the author of the new novel, The Elephant of Belfast. Kirk, thank you so much for talking with us. And please look us up next time you're in state.
Thank you so much for having me, April.
S. Kirk Walsh will be doing a virtual event organized by Literati Bookstore in Ann Arbor. It's coming up on Tuesday, April 13th, and you register to attend from your home. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.